Time traveling friends, and welcome back to this second episode in our very special month-long series, In the Footsteps of Mary, Queen of Scots, as I go on an adventure in time north of the border to explore some of the most historic and iconic locations associated with Mary's time in Scotland. Now, if you tuned into week one, you will know that our first stop on our road trip was Linlithgow Palace. This, of course, was the scene of Mary's birth in a very cold winter of 1542. And Anne Daly did a marvellous job of bringing the story of Mary and Linlithgow to life. Now I am on the road again, and I've headed around about 18 miles northwest to visit Stirling and its impressive fortress, Stirling Castle, which of course was a place which was so important in Mary's story, being largely her childhood home before she went to live in France, and of course saw some of the early romantic developments around her relationship, her fated relationship with Henry, Lord Darnley. So we are heading deeper into Scotland towards the Highlands. In fact, as you will hear in this podcast, Stirling was a very important strategic location in the 16th century. It was, in fact, the gateway to the Highlands. And if you go there for yourself today, you will still admire the beautiful and dramatic countryside that surrounds the palace and its impressive position, located perched upon a very high, craggy outcrop of land above the town of Stirling itself. In this episode, I meet up with Elizabeth Manson. Now, Liz is the president of the Mary Stuart Society, and you join our conversation in the heart of the castle as we begin our adventure in time. So welcome to this second podcast in the series of In the Footsteps of Mary, Queen of Scots. And today I am at probably one of the most popular locations associated with Mary, and that's the mighty Stirling Castle. And I'm joined today by Liz Manson, Hello. President of the Mary Stuart Society.
Thank you.
Welcome to the Tudor Travel Show, Liz.
Thank you. Absolutely delighted to be here.
I just want to, first of all, thank you so much for helping me put together this tour, because the Mary Stuart Society have been absolutely awesome in helping put together guests who were able to come on these podcasts. So thank you very much.
Great. Not at all. We're absolutely delighted. We're all passionate about the life and times of Mary, so we love sharing it with people. So thank you for the opportunity.
That's okay. So what we're going to do today is we're going to pick up the story of Mary, Queen of Scots. First of all, when she arrives here from Linlithgow, but of course Stirling also played a major part in her life after her return from France. So it's a bit disjointed chronologically, but we're going to do our best. And as we talk about the life and times of Mary Stuart here at Stirling, we're also hopefully going to be doing a bit of walking and talking and hopefully trying to create for you some of the magnificent buildings. So on that note, just let me kick off by saying we're in the inner courtyard, I guess,
yes,
aren't we?
Yes, we're in the palace area.
And so what have we got in front of us? Do you just want to just try and tell us what we can see here?
Yes, well, we can see the exterior of the Great Hall, and it was refurbished not that long ago in historical terms, and it was painted to be the original colour that it was. So it's this sort of lovely, sort of light caramel colour. Yeah. And as a result, it stands out for miles across the Scottish countryside. And at the time that was done, it was quite controversial. And who knows, maybe at the time that it was built, it was also controversial. But it's a beautiful building. It's got lots of interesting crenellations and towers and
turrets,
crowns and lions, Scottish unicorns right across this roof. And beside it is the royal apartments, which obviously played a part, as you see, in Mary's life at different times. The gardens at Stirling are also very well established. It started off as a sort of hunting ground, and as the fashion for gardening became more popular, Stirling has become one of the most iconic layouts in Scottish palaces and castles.
Well, you talk about the early history, and maybe I just want to try and create a sense of what the castle looks like and where it is, because as you approach, you see the castle, don't you? Sat really high up. And there's kind of mountains surrounding on one side. It's a very dramatic and quite beautiful landscape,
yes,
isn't it?
And Stirling is sometimes called the brooch in Scotland because it combines the lowlands and the highlands. And that probably tells you a little bit about why it was such a popular place for monarchs to stay as they toured around their kingdom. But its situation, as you say, high up on volcanic rock, a bit like Edinburgh Castle. And because of its height, it gives a fantastic view across any potential marauding forces. And so it's a really strong defensive fortification. And that was one of the reasons, again, why it had a long history. Mary's grandfather had built a fortification here, but it was really her father, influenced by the French Renaissance style. He brought across masons from France, and I think this is characterised. It's why perhaps it does feel familiar to some of the chateau that Mary stayed in when she was a little girl in France.
It certainly does feel like that. And I think I read somewhere when I was researching about Stirling that it was kind of, if you held Stirling, you held Scotland, because it was such a pivotal location,
right,
between the lowlands and the highlands. And there was lots of skirmishes, weren't there, before Mary's
days,
between the English
of famous,
and the Scottish.
Yep, lots of famous people. It was always a place of
contention.
Indeed.
So let's pick up the story of Mary, because she came here from Linlithgow, and in our podcast we were hearing a little bit about the reasons for her being conveyed to Stirling. But maybe you can pick up the story of when she came here and what we know of her arrival here at Stirling.
Yeah, so she came here when she was just 8 months old. You will have heard that clearly there was the rough wooing between England and Scotland, so she was brought here partly because of its defensive situation. But the castle was owned by Mary de Guise. It was given to her as part of her dowry. So it belonged to Mary's family, if you like. So there would have been a family connection. But Mary de Guise owned it, and therefore the governor of Scotland, the Earl of Arran, could not claim it. He had control of a number of other places in Scotland, particularly Edinburgh Castle and Holyrood Palace. So it was a place that Marie de Guise owned, and she could bring Mary here of her own accord.
So she clearly felt very safe here, of all the places in Scotland that she could come to. What do we know of her transfer or arrival here? Are there any records
of
that?
Yes, there is, and it was full of pomp and circumstance.
Was it?
Because she, as you can imagine, the Queen came with her, which again was quite an unusual situation, that Marie de Guise did not want to be separated from her young daughter. So when Mary came from Linlithgow to Stirling, it really was quite a cavalcade. They brought with them, as they did in those times, their beds, tapestries, their clothing, of course, coffers are listed in the records, and she also brought kitchen equipment, and we know, for example, that they brought spits with them in the cartloads that came along. She was accompanied by 2,500 cavalry and 1,000 foot soldiers, so it must have been a real spectacle for the people of Scotland to see that coming across the land.
It must have been amazing, this snake with all its glittering colour. I often love to think of, you know, the 16th century folk on progress and just how awesome that would have been for the everyday peasant in the land. Okay, great. So what do we know of her time here? in those first sort of, you know, few years? Because she stayed here for, what, 5 years?
Yes, she did. And I suppose the important thing that happened when she was here was her coronation.
Uh-huh.
And that, although the English ambassadors had a pretty poor view of it, he thought that it was very, very poor in their terms, but it clearly was an important occasion, because although technically she was Queen of Scotland after her father died, the coronation was an important moment.
Yes.
And it was the first time significantly that the honours of Scotland were used, and I think that will be an image familiar to people in Edinburgh Castle, the crown, the sceptre and the orb, and they were carried in to her coronation by leading lords.
So were they created for her, or were they already in existence?
They were already in existence, but they had been remodelled, I think, over the years. But so the ones that we have today were created for Mary, Queen of Scots.
So they were used in that ceremony?
They were used in that
ceremony.
Wow,
I mean, that's amazing, of course, because the English crown jewels were completely lost in the Civil War. So the fact that you've still got those 16th century, you called them what?
Well, they've been remodelled, I think.
The
honours of Scotland are called, but they have been remodelled over the years. But that was a significant moment, and Mary allegedly cried, in fact not just cried, howled throughout the whole ceremony. And in fact, normally part of a coronation, somebody reads out the list, the lineage, you know, I guess they do that to prove the entitlement of that particular monarch to be crowned. But Mary cried so lustily and so loudly that they decided to skip that part, because it normally takes about half an hour.
Ah, I see.
So they made an executive decision, obviously, not to include that.
Because she was how old at the time?
She was 10 months,
Ten months old, so just a little wee one. So her coronation was September. September, so the year following her birth in September.
Right.
Now, so obviously that happened in the Chapel Royal, and once again, folks, some of the castle is generally restricted, but the Chapel Royal is one of those places that it's open. So why don't we go over and have a look?
And see the place that it happened.
And see the place that it happened. So we've come even deeper into the heart of the castle, and we're now surrounded, I guess, by royal lodgings and one side of the Great Hall, and then in front of us is the chapel. And I guess we were standing, you know, kind of where the coronation procession would have passed across the courtyard and into the chapel. But Liz, what do we know about this chapel?
Well, the chapel was part of the first iteration of the building, so it had a long history, and it's been through a number of remodelings. But at the time that Mary was here, it was still laid out as a Catholic chapel, although her coronation was undertaken under a Protestant ceremony. But it's a fairly traditional design. It's not an enormous building. And the one that's here today was actually remodelled by her son, James VI, for the baptism of his son, because clearly when he found it wasn't in a good enough condition for him to use for his son's baptism. But it was still in a Catholic layout when Mary was here as a little girl, when she returned from France, and indeed when she had her son baptised here.
Mm. So I think it's important to point out, isn't it, that the chapel that we see isn't the one that Mary was crowned in.
It's been remodelled
on the site of. When we go inside, which is what we're going to do in a moment, we're not seeing the original interiors that Mary would have known. We're going to see something different. So why don't we just go in and have a quick look and see what we can see.
Good.
Right. Thank you.
So we've come inside the Chapel Royal. You might be able to hear that we've entered quite a large and cavernous space. There is a kind of a raised platform at, I guess, the low end, which is facing the high altar, with these large elongated arched windows, which are very plain. There's no stained glass, but there is beautiful wall paintings around the top of the room, which were painted for Charles I, who visited Stirling in the early 1600s. So as part of these wall paintings, at the end with the high altar, there are some paintings that, Liz, you were pointing out to me, are very relevant to the coronation regalia. What can we see?
Yes, just at one end, right up at the top of the ceiling above the window, is the Lion of Scotland, showing with the crown and the sword and the sceptre, which together make up the honours of Scotland. So the fact that that was painted for what would have been Mary's grandson, and indeed her great-grandson coming here, you can see the tradition of the Scottish honours being part of that heritage.
It's quite a moving and peaceful space, and lovely to think and imagine that it was in this place that Mary, Queen of Scots, was crowned, with her cries ringing out through the Chapel Royal and echoing around the walls. So Mary was here at Stirling Castle for how long, Liz?
She was here for about the first 5 years of her life, other than a very short spell at Dunkeld and 3 weeks at Inchmahome Priory. So this would have been very much her childhood home.
It is, isn't it? It's the childhood home, yeah, of Mary, Queen of Scots, absolutely. So then she went to France, and that was really, that was what Mary de Guise wanted for her, wasn't it? She didn't want any kind of alliance with England. She wanted her daughter to be married to the Dauphin of France.
Yes, and again, I suppose she would have seen that as a family connection.
Absolutely.
The Scottish people, I think, changed their minds a few times about whether or not they wanted Mary to be married to Henry VIII's son, which would have been a very stable Britain at that time. But clearly there was a conflict between Scotland and England at the time, and a fear that England would dominate Scotland. So yes, the contract was eventually made that Mary would marry the Dauphin of France, and the negotiations concluded. She left here for Dumbarton Castle in February, and she left Scotland in 1548, and she left Scotland later that year.
So we're, of course, focusing on Mary's time in Scotland. I mean, there are plenty of wonderful places to visit if you wish to go on the trail of Mary, Queen of Scots, in France. But our focus is Scotland. And what I wanted to talk to you about, Liz, was her return here. Because obviously she did come to Stirling. And in fact, she spent quite a lot of time here. And there were some important events that happened here. So maybe you could just tell us about when Mary was here during her adult life.
Yeah. So when she came back to Scotland, she arrived in Edinburgh and she stayed there for some time. And then in 1562, she came here for around a month in September, and she spent most of October and November here. Much of her time during that period, she went on royal progresses. She clearly recognised that there was value in her people seeing her, and we didn't have any other methods in those days, so she literally got on her horse and toured around Scotland. And one of the society's projects, one of our members has catalogued every place that Mary, Queen of Scots, stayed throughout her life, and it is quite incredible just the miles she travelled. And Stirling was, of course, a really good point in the middle of Scotland, as we've said, and there are many records that she stopped here for a night or a couple of nights as she went around. Indeed, she quite often stayed here if she was going to weddings or going to see friends, much as, as indeed royals and others do as part of their normal lives. So it was something that, it was a place that would have been familiar to her and very comfortable to her, and she would have remembered it as home.
And of course, I imagine when she was here, like any noble aristocrat of the 16th century, there was plenty of hunting and hawking and dining and feasting.
Yes, I think she had a great time. There are many records, as I say, of her going to visit friends, of her going to weddings. And yes, she did love the gardens at Stirling and the hunting opportunities that it presented.
And I keep having to remind myself, she was only a young woman, wasn't she, in her early 20s?
So well, full not of even life. That.
And even
that,
earlier than that when she came back. So she was full
was
of life.
And and she had, so she was also conducting courts and doing of work of the monarch at that time. Yeah. And it was quite a lot for a teenager to take on, I think, at those times.
Well, we were talking about feasting, etc., and we're actually stood right outside one of the entrances to the Great Hall. So I think we should go in and have a look and take in the atmosphere of the Great Hall here at Stirling, where I imagine a lot of that feasting took place.
I think so, yes. It was certainly a party place.
So I'm excited because we're going through this huge oak door. And we must be in the low end because it looks like there's a screens passage. And then, oh my word. Oh, it's beautiful, isn't it, Liz?
So it's a fantastic roof, I think.
It is. I mean, actually, I think it looks even bigger from the inside than the outside. Mm-hmm. I mean, it is a vast hall. In fact, I would say this is on the scale of Hampton Court Palace Hall.
Mm-hmm. And it's got four wonderful fireplaces, and you can just imagine in a particularly important feasting night, the fire's roaring. We've got the usual minstrel's gallery up at one end.
And the candles flickering, and then no doubt, I mean, there's fabric curtain has been hung, but I guess the walls would have just been
tapestries
glistening in the candlelight. And you've got this lovely kind of, I suppose it is a form of, I'm not an architectural historian, but it is like a hammer beam roof, isn't it? And then, of course, at the top end, we have the raised dais.
The raised dais where the royals would have been sitting, interestingly, 2 metres apart.
Yes, indeed. I'm afraid we have a social distancing sign here.
That's right. And the coats of arms and the windows round about the Lords of Scotland.
So there's two oriel windows on either side, actually, aren't there? And they're pretty vast. Even in Hampton Court, there's only one small oriel window. And here you've got two, which are probably double the width of those at Hampton Court. Mm-hmm. It's quite spectacular. I feel as though we need to go and sit and be king and queen for a moment.
And just behind the royal table, obviously, there's the Scottish coat of arms and the In My Defence motto with two unicorns, which is very splendid. And St Andrew's just down at the bottom with his cross.
And then behind the actual sort of where the top table would have been, there's yet another
fireplace.
Beautiful fireplace, glorious. So what I'm going to do is I'm obviously going to be taking some pictures, and I'll be including those in a link in the description with this podcast so you can see some of the things that we're talking about. So we've come over to one of the oriel windows, and we're looking out across a wonderful mountain range, and there's a monument there. What's that, Liz?
That's the Wallace Monument.
So what's that about?
That's a bit before my period, but it's the Scottish Wars of Independence, which were obviously many hundreds of years before. But I think it does demonstrate to you how important this part of Scotland is.
Yes.
And the history and the turmoil that the Stirling Castle area has seen.
And there's the river down there as well. Is that
that was so important in the Battle of Stirling Bridge and William Wallace. The success of that battle for him was very much because of his military genius using the water in the river.
Oh, that's fantastic. As you say, it's a little bit out of our time period, but it's hard to ignore because it's actually such a beautiful view from the top here of the castle across the Scottish countryside. Thank you. one of the perhaps most splendid events of the period we're interested in that took place in this great hall was the christening celebrations for Mary's son.
That's right, and that will be one reason why Stirling was a very special place to her, because her son was baptised in the Chapel Royal, and then there were 3 days of celebrations because Scotland was just so delighted to have a male heir. Oh, yes. And indeed, as was Mary, having fulfilled her duty as a queen. So there were 3 days of pageantry, of feasting, of fireworks. There was so much expenditure that Mary had to borrow £12,000 from the merchants of Edinburgh, and the Parliament agreed a special taxation to allow her to repay that. There were many dignitaries came from far and wide, and they had a really splendid party. On the third day, they had a tournament down just in the outside the castle walls. And she had modelled the whole 3 days in the theme of reconciliation, which related to some pageantry that Catherine de' Medici, her former mother-in-law, had done in France just the year before. And so she was using the baptismal celebrations of James to send a message to the lords who had been involved with the murder of Rizzio, her secretary. So it wasn't just how fabulous it was to have a male child in Scotland. Mary was using that as a political manoeuvre and a demonstration for her lords.
And am I right in saying by this time her marriage to Lord Darnley had well and truly fallen apart, and he didn't want any, or he wasn't anywhere to be seen during
this? That's right. He refused to come into the chapel. And a lot of that was about, he was very petty, and he took great affront at the refusal to be called King of Scotland, and he therefore refused to be part of the baptismal ceremony.
He really threw his toys out of the pram there, didn't he? But he was at Stirling at the time, but just refused to participate.
Yes, just wouldn't come in. And Mary had her son baptised in Catholic rites, so all the Protestant lords had to stay out, and indeed Elizabeth's representative, who was Protestant, but she did join in the baptismal ceremony. And Elizabeth was officially a godmother and sent a fabulous gold christening font for the ceremony.
But that doesn't survive,
I guess. No, we think it's been melted down very, very quickly afterwards.
So it didn't survive very long.
It did not.
It had more monetary worth than its gold.
Far too valuable.
Very pragmatic. Well, I think with that, we are going to be able to go in and explore the royal apartments, and we're very lucky because actually at the moment they are not currently open to the public, but we have been given a special invitation to go around and see inside the chambers that Mary lived in when she was here at Stirling. So Liz, we've come inside the royal apartments. Now, my understanding is that these royal apartments were built around a quadrangle.
Yes.
And there's a kind of an inner courtyard.
That's right.
Called the Lion's Den,
I
think.
Yeah.
Not quite sure what exactly the story is around that, but it sounds like it might have been an interesting one. But we're here in the West Gallery, so my understanding is this is where you would come if you were going to
meet the Queen.
So we would conduct yourself. It's a stone gallery, isn't it? And we're heading in through a lovely square stone archway, and this takes us into the Queen's outer hall. So obviously one side was the Queen's side,
and the other side was the King's side,
and they kind of mirrored each other.
Yes.
And I think there were 3 main apartments. There was an outer hall, an inner hall, and then
and
the bed
chamber. Yep.
And for those of you who are listening in, you'll be very familiar with the fact that I've written quite a lot about the flow and the progress of royal chambers, and so these pretty much mirror what you would expect to see in an English royal palace. You have the larger chamber.
Yeah. Where people just waited as they arrived until you were summoned into the next room.
So we've got, obviously there's been a lot of renovation at here.
Yes, they were just done in 2011, so it's still very new, but it's clearly been done to reflect the period of the time, and the frieze around the edge shows the usual Scottish unicorns, And the sort of burgundy and ivory colouring that that would certainly brighten up an environment.
It's very vibrant, isn't it? The colours, the reds, and we have the stained glass in the window, and then beautiful coat of arms over this enormous fireplace, and you can imagine that just a blaze keeping the room warm while you waited and paced backwards and forwards to hear if you were going to get any kind of audience with the Queen. So we were just chatting, weren't we, with the castle manager here at Stirling, who was telling us when Mary was here as a child, she probably occupied the Prince's Tower.
That's right, but she would have been familiar with these rooms if this was where her mother was holding court, and indeed later on when she came back herself. So she would have indeed been in these very, very halls.
A lot of history happened here. So we're going to assume that we have the status and the invitation to pass through into the next room. So we're going through yet another arch door. It's slightly smaller this time, but we're going into this, oh my goodness, amazing chamber. So this has really been recreated with such splendour. I don't even know where to start to describe it. Shall we try, Liz?
Absolutely. I mean, I think the first thing that strikes you when you come into this room is the canopy of state that is sitting above the throne, which has the usual coat of arms upon it with a unicorn and an eagle this time. And everything's in very sumptuous burgundy velvet. So it does have a very regal feel to it.
Yes, and of course there's the carpet. And of course, I presume this was probably the same in Scotland, but in England, you weren't allowed to step on that carpet unless you were the monarch yourself. So that just gives extra added status. And of course, to the left, well, not of course, but to the left, you've got another ornate fireplace, which would keep the Queen nice and warm.
That's right.
She was holding
cozy.
Audience.
Keep her cosy. And I think that the tapestries around the room are depicting hunting scenes. Some of them would be familiar to those who were coming in. The usual white stag and hunting dogs, and very reminiscent, because Stirling Gardens was a hunting lodge, hunting area, that it's very appropriate that these are the tapestries that are on display.
They really are beautiful, and I guess these were recreated specifically for the refurbishment of the palace.
Yes, I think there are similar tapestries in other properties like this. And this is the very room where we expect that Marie de Guise was advised that her armies had been unsuccessful at the Battle of Pinkieclough. And I think that would have been a particularly important part in Mary's story, because that really just sealed the fact she would go to France.
Right, okay, so it really was a tipping point. Gosh, I can just see Marie de Guise there now, just taking
hearing the bad
that.
News.
I wonder what she said.
Or maybe good news, if she wanted to send Mary to France.
Well, indeed.
it would just have sealed the deal.
Oh, and just before we leave this room, we've actually got a replica of a sideboard, which was a very much a feature of any presence chamber, including those in English palaces. And that's where the gold and silver plate would be displayed on tiered stands. And of course, that was an indicator of the wealth of the person who owned the building, in this case, obviously, royalty. Okay, Liz, let's assume that we have been given permission.
They've been invited in.
Private audience with Her Majesty. And you can probably hear the sound changes as we go into a slightly smaller chamber. And this feels even more sumptuously decorated and more private. We're in the Queen's bedchamber now.
We are indeed, but it wasn't just a bedchamber. There was eating and there were audiences held in her bedchamber. So it wasn't simply for sleeping in, although obviously her bed is indeed here.
No, in fact.
Draped and with regal purple.
With regal purple, and of course you have the desk and the X-frame chair, which, as you say, would be a great place to write your letters, do your correspondence.
That's right.
Etc.
Hear petitions and people asking for things, no doubt. And the canopy of state in this room is even more ornate.
It's absolutely beautiful. And again, what I will do is I will include some photographs in a blog accompanying this podcast, so you can see these for yourself. Oh, I just wonder what kind of conversations happened in this room.
things I really wanted to talk to you about, Liz, was the Darnley incident. Because, of course, this here at Stirling is said to be the place that Mary probably got swept off her feet by the young lad. So what can you tell us about that?
Well, Mary met Darnley in the February and they had got on fine. I think he had been dispatched by Elizabeth I as a potential English nobleman, a potential suitable person for her to be with. And it seemed to go sort of fairly smoothly at the start, but it was really when they were both here in April that I think the romance began. They
and
started
that'd be
behaving
April
like 60, a couple. 1565.
Okay.
So they had really just begun what seemed to be a normal relationship, that they clearly enjoyed each other's company. They went out riding, they were hunting, they played billiards, and they clearly developed feelings for each other. But what seemed to seal the deal was that poor Darnley became ill. It was a cold, and then people thought it developed into measles. There is a suspicion now that it was, unfortunately, it was the first stages of syphilis.
Oh dear.
But at the time, it was seen to be something much more innocent than that. And Mary was nursing him. She was a very maternal person, she was a very caring person, and clearly this played very much into her her style of caring for somebody. And she became a nurse to Darnley. She was popping up to see him in the he was given the royal apartments, which was a very unusual treat for someone. It was a really high honour to be given to him, so he was clearly somebody very special. And she would take him food from the supper table, and she was visiting him all times of day and indeed after midnight, which had been very shocking to people.
Yes.
So that really was where I think she developed much more romantic and deeper feelings for him. And once that had started, she was quite a headstrong woman, and when she'd kind of decided, when she'd fallen in love, and I think it genuinely she did fall in love with him, she said he was the lustiest and best proportioned lang man she had ever seen. So he was good at dancing, he was good at languages, so compared to her first husband Francois, he was a real man, and he enjoyed doing the same things Mary did. So that was it, really.
The chemistry sparked.
Absolutely. But Darnley was clearly playing a part. His true nature sadly came to the fore quite soon afterwards, but by which point Mary, they were set on a path to marriage, and she was in such haste that she didn't even wait for the formal permission from Rome to come through. And they got married in the July.
It's such a puzzling, I don't know, kind of, with the way it all fell apart so horrifically badly, so quickly. I always find it so immensely puzzling in some ways that she didn't see any of this.
I
mean, she must have been truly blinded by love.
Yes, and people warned her. Her stepbrother said he could not approve of the marriage.
Yes, Darnley was deeply unpopular, wasn't he?
Yes, with the lords, and that headstrong nature of Mary, she felt that, you know, this was the man for her. But clearly part of the attraction was he had a link to the English throne. And so she wasn't all heart and no head.
No, because Mary was always pursuing her claim to the English throne, wasn't
yes,
she?
Yes, and I think she genuinely believed that she was the rightful heir, because as a Catholic she genuinely believed that Anne Boleyn was a bigamous marriage and that Elizabeth was not legitimate. And that clouded her view. I think she was just unable to ever accept that Elizabeth was legitimate. And so she just felt that she was the rightful heir. It wasn't an avaricious wanting to grab the English land or to add the English throne. She thought she was the rightful heir.
It's a principle.
Yes.
And I think sometimes we maybe don't get the same sense of principle and consciousness and the religious conviction.
Yes, and that she was an anointed queen, and she had been brought up in France by her mother's family, the Guise family, to believe that she was the rightful heir.
Yes, right.
So she just couldn't see beyond that.
Right, yeah, absolutely. Well, I know we're going to be picking up the story of Lord Darnley when we meet again, in fact, in a couple of days' time, because we are going to be meeting at
Holyrood, where some fairly dramatic events
unfolded. Absolutely, more dramatic events.
So let's put the Darnley story on hold and pick that up then. So I guess we're coming to the end of our chat here. I suppose there's just a couple of questions I would want to ask you about, you know, visiting Stirling as a town. Obviously, they're here, we're here at the castle. What else might people want to see? Is there anything else in the town that you shouldn't miss if you're interested in Mary, Queen of Scots, or her story?
Yeah, well, there is the church next door, the Church of the Holyrood, and that is where James the Sixth. There's an annual lecture every year, and that was an important location for his coronation. And that coronation was took place just after they had forced Mary to abdicate, and it was a very rushed coronation. Yeah. But that's clearly an important location. And Bannockburn and other parts of Scottish history are round about the Stirling area. Yeah. So you can get a sense of just why Stirling is an important place in Scotland.
Yeah, great. Well, I just thank you so much for sharing your piece of the story of Mary, Queen of Scots, and your love and passion for her. And as I say, I will see you at Holyrood.
See you soon. Thank you.
Now, I know from many of you and my interactions with you on social media that for those of you who visited Scotland and some of the places associated with Mary, Stirling is one of the most popular, and it's not hard to see why, with its dramatic scenery and the wonderful recreation of the 16th century royal apartments as Mary and her mother would have known them. Well, it makes for a very, very satisfying visit. But in the meantime, I'd like to thank Liz for being our guide today. And in fact, it's not the last time we'll be hearing from her, because I have the pleasure of meeting up with Liz again at Holyrood Palace when we explore the dramatic and traumatic events that unfolded there, particularly around the murder of her secretary, David Rizzio. And so, in fact, yes, that's probably appropriate for me to say something about what you can expect in next week's episode, because we do not begin at Holyrood Palace. In fact, befittingly, I meet up with Jerry Ozaniek at the Esplanade in front of Edinburgh Castle. And Jerry takes us on a guided tour down the Royal Mile as we follow in the footsteps of Mary, Queen of Scots, as she is or was formally received by the city of Edinburgh after her return to the country of her birth in August 1561. And then at the bottom of the Royal Mile, I indeed meet up with Liz and we explore some of the events that I have just mentioned. So I hope you are going to join me for our third episode of In the Footsteps of Mary, Queen of Scots, which will go live next week on Saturday. Until then, my friends, I hope you have enjoyed this week's episode, and I look forward to meeting up with you again on the road next week. And until then, of course, all that remains for me to say is happy time travelling.